Chapter 20. Into Andor. Elaine hoped that the journey to Camelin would go smoothly, and in the beginning it seemed to do so. She thought that, even as she and Avienda and Birgitta sat bone-weary and huddled in the rags that remained of their clothing, filthy with dirt and dust and the blood of the injuries they had received when the gateway exploded. In 2 weeks at most, she would be ready to present her claims to the Lion Throne. There on the hilltop, Nynaeve healed their numerous hurts and spoke barely a word, certainly not berating them. Surely that was a pleasant sign, if unusual. Relief at finding them alive battled worry on her face. Lan's strength was necessary to remove the Shan-Chan crossbow bolt from Birgitta's thigh before she could be healed of that wound, but although her face drained of blood, and Elaine felt a stab of agony through the bond, agony that made her want to cry out, her warder barely groaned through her gritted teeth.
"Tyshar Kandor,"
Lan murmured, tossing the pile-head quarrel, made to punch through armor, aside on the ground. "True blood of Kandor." Birgitta blinked, and he paused.
"Forgive me if I erred. I assumed from your clothes you were Kandori."
"Oh, yes," Birgitta breathed. "Kandori." Her sickly grin might have been from her injuries. Nynaeve was impatiently shooing Lan out of the way so she could lay hands on her. Elaine hoped the woman knew more of Kandor than the name. When Birgitta had last been born, there had been no Kandor. She should have taken it as an omen. For the 5 miles to the small, slate-roofed manor house, Birgitta rode behind Nynaeve on the latter's stout brown mare, named Lover's Knot of all things, and Elaine and Avienda rode Lan's tall black stallion. At least Elaine sat Mandarb's saddle, with Avienda's arms around her waist, while Lan led the fiery-eyed animal. Trained warhorses were as much weapons as a sword, and dangerous mounts for strange riders. "Be sure of yourself, girl," Linny had always told her, "but not too sure." And she did try. She should have realized events were no more in her control than Mandarb's reins. At the 3-story stone house, Master Hornwell, stout and gray-haired, and Mistress Hornwell, slightly less round and slightly less gray, but otherwise resembling her husband remarkably, had every last person who worked the estates, and Marilla's maid Pole, and the green-and-white liveried servants who had come from the Tarasin Palace as well, all bustling to find sleeping accommodations for over 200 people, most women, who had appeared out of nowhere with dark near to falling. The work went with surprising swiftness, in spite of the estate's people stopping to gawk at an Aes Sedai ageless face, or a warder's shifting cloak making parts of him vanish, or one of the sea folk with all of her bright silks, her earrings and nose ring and medallion chain. Kinswomen were deciding that now it was safe to be frightened and cry, no matter what Rihanna and the knitting circle said to them. Windfinders were snarling over how far from the salt they had come, against their will, as Rhaenylad and Callan loudly claimed, and nobles and craftswomen who had been all too willing to flee whatever lay back in Ebudar, willing to carry their bundled possessions on their backs, were now balking at being shown a hayloft for a bed. All that was going on when Elaine and the others arrived with the sun red on the western horizon, a great upheaval and milling all about the house and thatch-roofed outbuildings. But Alice Tengila, smiling pleasantly and implacable as an avalanche, seemed to have everything more in hand than even the capable Hornwells. Kinswomen who wept harder for all of Rihanna's attempts at comfort dried their tears at a murmur from Alice, and began moving with the purposeful air of women who had been caring for themselves in a hostile world for many years. Haughty nobles, with marriage knives dangling into the oval cutouts in their lace-trimmed bodices, and craftswomen who displayed almost as much arrogance and nearly as much bosom, if not in silk, flinched at the sight of Elise approaching and went scurrying for the tall barns, hugging their bundles and announcing loudly that they had always thought it might be amusing to sleep on straw. Even the windfinders, many of them important and powerful women among the Atha'an Mier, muffled their complaints when Elise came near. For that matter, Saritha, still lacking the Aes Sedai agelessness, eyed Elise askance and touched her brown-fringed shawl, as if to remind herself it was there. Marilla, unflappable Marilla, watched the woman go about her work with a blend of approval and open amazement. Clambering down from her saddle at the front door of the house, Nynaeve glared toward Elise, gave her dark braid one deliberate, measured tug that the other woman was far too busy to notice, and stalked inside, stripping off her blue riding gloves and muttering to herself. Watching her go, Lan chuckled softly, then stifled his laughter immediately when Elaine dismounted. Light, but his eyes were cold. For Nynaeve's sake, she hoped the man could be saved from his fate, yet looking into those eyes, she did not believe it. "Where is Ispan?" she murmured, helping Avienda scramble down. So many of the women knew an Aes Sedai, a black sister, was being held prisoner, that the news was bound to spread through the estates like fire in dry grass, but better if the manor's folk had a little preparation. "Adelius and Van Deen took her to a small woodcutter's hut about half a mile away," he replied just as quietly. "In all this, I don't think anyone noticed a woman with a sack over her head. The sisters said they would stay there with her tonight." Elaine shivered. The dark friend was to be questioned again once the sun went down, it seemed. They were in Andor now, and that made her feel more deeply as if she had given the order for it. Soon she was in a copper bathtub, luxuriating in perfumed soap and clean skin again, laughing and splashing water at Birgitta, who lolled in another tub, except when she was splashing back, both of them giggling over the wincing horror Avienda could not quite conceal at sitting up to her breasts in water. She thought it was a very good joke on herself, though, and told a most improper story about a man getting cigada spines in his bottom. Birgitta told one still more improper, about a woman getting her head caught between the slats of a fence, that made even Avienda blush. They were funny, though. Elaine wished she knew one to tell. She and Avienda combed and brushed one another's hair, a nightly ritual for near-sisters, and then they snuggled tiredly into the canopied bed in a small room. She and Avienda, Birgitta and Nynaeve, and lucky there were no more. Larger rooms had cots and pallets covering the floors, including the sitting rooms, the kitchens, and most of the halls. Nynaeve muttered half the night about the indecency of making a woman sleep apart from her husband, and for the other half her elbows seemed to wake Elaine every time she dropped off. Birgitta flatly refused to change places, and she could not ask Avienda to endure the woman's sharp prodding, so she did not get a great deal of sleep. Elaine was still groggy when they prepared to depart the next morning, with the rising sun a molten ball of gold. The manor had few animals to spare unless she stripped the estates bare, so while she rode a black gelding named Fireheart, and Avienda and Birgitta had new mounts, those who had been afoot when they fled the kin's farm remained afoot. That included most of the kinswomen themselves, the servants leading the pack animals, and the 20-odd women who plainly were beyond regretting their visit to the kin's farm in hopes of peace and contemplation. The warders rode ahead to scout the way across rolling hills covered in drought-starved forest, and the rest of them stretched out in a most peculiar snake, with Nynaeve and herself and the other sisters at the head, and Avienda, of course. It was hardly a group that could escape notice, so many women traveling with so few men for guards, not to mention 20 dark windfinders, awkward on their horses and as bright as exotically plumaged birds, and 9 Aes Sedai, 6 of them recognizably so to anyone who knew what to look for. Though one did ride with a leather sack over her head, of course, as if that would not attract eyes by itself. Elaine had hoped to reach Camelin unnoticed, but that no longer seemed possible. Still, there was no reason that anyone would suspect that the daughter heir, Elaine Trakand herself, was one of this group. In the beginning, she thought that the greatest difficulty they might face would be someone who opposed her claims, learning of her presence, sending armed men to try taking her into custody until the succession was settled. In truth, she expected the first trouble to come from the footsore craftswomen and nobles, proud women all, and none used to tramping dusty hills, especially since Marilla's maid had her own plump mare to ride. The few farm wives among them did not seem to mind too much, but nearly half their number were women who possessed lands and manors and palaces, and most of the rest could have afforded to buy an estate, if not two or three. They included two goldsmiths, three weavers who owned over 400 looms between them, a woman whose manufactories produced a tenth of all the lacquerware Ebu Dar produced, and a banker. They walked, their possessions strapped to their backs, while their horses bore pack saddles laden with food. There was real need. Every last coin in everyone's purse had been pooled together and given into Nynaeve's tight-fisted keeping, but all might not be sufficient to buy food, fodder, and lodgings for so large a party all the way to Camelin. They did not seem to understand. They complained loudly and incessantly through the first day's march. Loudest of all was a slim lady with a thin scar on one cheek, a stern-faced woman named Malian, who was nearly bent double under the weight of a huge bundle containing a dozen or more dresses and all the changes that went with them. When they made camp that first night, with their cook-fires glowing in the twilight and everyone full of beans and bread, if not entirely satisfied with them, Malian gathered the noblewomen around her, their silks more than travel-stained. The craftswomen joined in, too, and the banker and the farmers stood close. Before Malian could say a word, Rihanna strode into the group, her face full of smile lines in plain brown woolens with her skirts sewn up on the left to expose bright layered petticoats. She might have been one of the farm women.
"If you wish to go home," she announced in that surprisingly high voice, "you may do so at any time. I regret that we must keep your horses, though. You will be paid for them as soon as can be arranged. If you choose to remain, please remember that the rules of the farm still apply."
A number of the women around her gaped. Malian was not alone in opening her mouth angrily. Alice just seemed to appear at Rihanna's side, fists planted on her hips. She was not smiling now.
"I said the last 10 to be ready would do the washing up," she told them firmly. And she named them off. Gillian, a plump goldsmith, Nysella, the cool-eyed banker, and all 8 of the nobles. They stood staring at her until she clapped her hands and said, "Don't make me invoke the rule on failure to do your share of the chores."
Malian, wide-eyed and muttering in disbelief, was the last to dart off and begin gathering dirty bowls. But the next morning she pared her bundle down, leaving lace-trimmed silk dresses and shifts to be trampled on the hillside as they departed. Elaine continued to expect an explosion, but Rihanna kept a firm hand on them, Alice kept a firmer, and if Malian and the others glared and muttered over the grease stains that grew on their clothes day by day, Rihanna had only to speak a few words to send them to their work. Alice only had to clap her hands. If the rest of the journey could have gone as smoothly, Elaine would have been willing to join those women in their greasy labors. Long before reaching Camelin, she knew that for a fact. Once they reached the first narrow, dusty road, little more than cart track, farms began to appear, thatched stone houses and barns clinging to the hillsides, or nestled in hollows. From then on, whether the land was hilly or flat, forested or cleared, they rarely spent many hours beyond sight of a farm or a village. At each of those, while the local folk goggled at the very strange strangers, Elaine tried to learn how much support House Trakand had, and what concerned the people most. Addressing those concerns would be important in making her claim to the throne strong enough to stand, as important as the backing of other houses. She heard a great deal, if not always what she wished to hear. Andorans claimed the right to speak their minds to the queen herself. They were hardly shy with a young noblewoman, no matter how peculiar her traveling companions. In a village called Demelian, where 3 mills sat beside a small river shrunken to leave their tall water wheels dry, the square-jawed innkeeper at the Golden Sheaves allowed as how he thought Morgaze had been a good queen, the best that could be, the best that ever was.
"Her daughter might have been a good ruler too, I suppose," he muttered, thumbing his chin. "Pity the dragon reborn killed them. I suppose he had to, the prophecies or some such. But he had no call to dry up the rivers, now did he? How much grain did you say your horses need, my lady?
It's dreadful dear, mind.
A hard-faced woman in a worn brown dress that hung on her as if she had lost weight surveyed a field surrounded by a low stone wall where the hot wind sent sheets of dust marching into the woods. The other farms around Berry Hill looked as bad or worse.
That dragon reborn's got no right to do this to us. Now has he? I ask you.
She spat and frowned up at Elaine in her saddle.
The throne? Oh, Dialin's as good as any now Morgays and her girl are dead. Some around here still speak up for Nain or Elenia, but I'm for Dialin. Any lookout, Camelin's a long way off. I've got crops to worry about, if I ever make another crop.
Oh, it's true, my lady, so it is. Elaine's alive,
a gnarled old carpenter told her in Foral Market. He was bald as a leather egg, his fingers twisted with age, but the work standing among the shavings and sawdust that littered his shop looked as fine as any Elaine had seen. She was the only person in the shop besides him. From the look of the village, half the residents had left.
The dragon reborn is having her brought to Camelin so he can put the rose crown on her head himself, he allowed. The news is all over. Tin' right, if you ask me. He's one of them black-eyed Aiel men, I hear. We ought to march on Camelin and drive him and all them Aiel back where they come from. Then Elaine can claim the throne her own self. If Dialin lets her keep it, anyway.
Elaine heard a great deal about Rand, rumors ranging from him swearing fealty to Elida to him being the king of Ilion of all things. In Andor he was blamed for everything bad that happened for the last 2 or 3 years, including stillbirths and broken legs, infestations of grasshoppers, two-headed calves, and three-legged chickens. And even people who thought her mother had ruined the country and an end to the reign of House Trakand was good riddance still believed Randall Thor an invader. The dragon reborn was supposed to fight the Dark One at Sheol Ghul, and he should be driven out of Andor. Not what she had hoped to hear. Not a bit of it. But she heard it all again and again. It was not a pleasant journey at all. It was one long lesson in one of Linny's favorite sayings. It isn't the stone you see that trips you on your nose. She thought a number of things beside the nobles might cause trouble, some sure to be explosions as great as the gateway. The Windfinders, smug in the bargain made with Nynaeve and herself, behaved in an irritatingly superior manner toward the Aes Sedai, especially after it came out that Marilla had let herself agree to be one of the first sisters to go the ships. Yet, if the sizzling there continued like the burning of an illuminator's fuse cord, the explosion never quite came. The Windfinders and the kinswomen, in particular the knitting circle, seemed as certain to blow up. They cut one another dead when not sneering openly, the kin at Seafolk Wilders getting above themselves, the Windfinders at cringing sand-lappers kissing Aes Sedai feet. But it never went beyond lips curled or daggers caressed. Ispan certainly presented problems that Elaine was sure would grow, yet after a few days Van Deen and Adelius let her ride unhooded, if not unshielded, a silent figure with colored beads in her thin braids, ageless face turned down and hands still on her reins. Renila told everyone who would listen that among the Athaan Mier, a dark friend was stripped of his or her names as soon as proven guilty, then thrown over the side tied to ballast stones. Among the kinswomen, even Rihanna and Elise paled every time they saw the Tarabonner woman. But Ispan grew meeker and meeker, eager to please and full of ingratiating smiles for the two white-haired sisters, no matter what it was they did to her when they carried her away from the others at night. On the other hand, Adelius and Van Deen grew more and more frustrated. Adelius told Nynaeve in Elaine's hearing that the woman spilled out volumes about old plots of the Black Aja, those she had not been involved in much more enthusiastically than those she was. Yet even when they pressed her hard, Elaine could not quite make herself ask how they pressed, and she let slip the names of dark friends. Most were certainly dead, and none was a sister. Van Deen said they were beginning to fear she had taken an oath.
the capital was audible, against betraying her cohorts. They continued to isolate Ispan as much as possible, and continued with their questions, but it was plain they were feeling their way blindly now, and carefully. And there was Nynaeve, and Lan. Most definitely Nynaeve and Lan, with her near to bursting at the effort of holding her temper around him, mooning over him when they had to sleep apart, which was nearly always the way accommodations divided up, and torn between eager and afraid when she could sneak him off to a hayloft. It was her own fault for choosing a sea-folk wedding, in Elaine's estimation. The sea-folk believed in hierarchy as they did in the sea, and they knew a woman and her husband might be promoted one past the other many times in their lives. Their marriage rights took that into account. Whoever had the right to command in public must obey in private. Lan never took advantage, so Nynaeve said. Not really, whatever that was supposed to mean. She always blushed when she said it, but she kept waiting for him to do so, and he just seemed to grow more and more amused. This amusement, of course, screwed Nynaeve's temper to a fever pitch. Nynaeve did erupt, out of all the explosions Elaine had expected. She snapped at anyone and everyone who got in her way, except at Lan. With him she was all honey and cream, and not at Elise. She came close once or twice, but even Nynaeve could not seem to make herself snap at Elise. Elaine had hopes, not worries, about the things brought out of the Rahad along with the Bowl of the Winds. Avienda helped her search, and so did Nynaeve once or twice, but she was entirely too slow and ginger about it and showed little skill at finding what they were searching for. They found no more Angrial, yet the collection of Turangrial grew once all the rubbish had been thrown away. Objects that used the one power filled 5 entire panniers on the pack horses. Careful as Elaine was, though, her attempts to study them did not go so well. Spirit was the safest of the 5 powers to use in this, unless, of course, spirit happened to be what triggered the thing. Yet at times she had to use other flows, as fine as she could weave. Sometimes her delicate probing did nothing, but her first touch at the thing that looked like a blacksmith's puzzle made of glass left her dizzy and unable to sleep for half the night. And a thread of fire touching what looked like a helmet made of fluffy metal feathers gave everyone within 20 paces a blinding headache, except for herself. And then there was the crimson rod that felt hot. Hot in a way. Sitting on the edge of her bed at an inn called the Wild Boar, she examined the smooth rod by the light of 2 polished brass lamps. Wrist thick and 1 foot long, it looked like stone, but felt firm rather than hard. She was alone. Since the helmet, she had tried to do her studying away from the others. The heat of the rod made her think of fire. Blinking, she opened her eyes and sat up in the bed. Sunlight streamed in at the window. She was in her shift, and Nynaeve, fully dressed, stood frowning down at her. Avienda and Birgitta were watching from beside the door. "What happened?" Elaine demanded, and Nynaeve shook her head grimly. "You don't want to know." Her lips twitched. Avienda's face gave away nothing. Brigitte's mouth might have been a little tight, but the strongest emotion Elaine felt from her was a combination of relief and hilarity. The woman was doing her utmost not to roll on the floor laughing. The worst of it was, no one would tell what had happened, what she had said or done. She was sure it was that, by the quickly hidden grins she saw, from kinswomen and windfinders as well as sisters, but no one would tell her. After that, she decided to leave studying the Turangreal to somewhere more comfortable than an inn, somewhere definitely more private. 9 days after their flight from Ebu Dar, scattered clouds appeared in the sky, and a sprinkling of fat raindrops splashed dust in the road. An intermittent drizzle fell the next day, and the day after a deluge kept them huddled in the houses and stables of Foral Market. That night the rain turned to sleet, and by morning thick flurries of snow drifted from a cloud-dark sky. More than halfway to Camelin, Elaine began to wonder whether they could make it in 2 weeks from where they stood. With the snow, clothes became a worry. Elaine blamed herself for not thinking of the fact that everyone might need warm clothes before they reached their destination. Nynaeve blamed herself for not thinking of it. Marilla thought she was at fault, and Rihanna thought she was. They actually stood in the main street of Foral Market that morning with snowflakes drifting down on their heads, arguing over who could claim the blame. Elaine was not sure which of them saw the absurdity first, who was the first to laugh, but all were laughing as they settled around a table in the White Swan to decide what to do. A solution turned out to be no laughing matter. Providing one warm coat or cloak for everyone would take a large bite out of their coin, if so many could be found. Jewelry could be sold or traded, of course, but no one in Foral Market seemed to be interested in necklaces or bracelets, however fine. Avienda solved that difficulty by producing a small sack that bulged with clear, perfect gemstones, some quite large. Strangely, the same folk who had said with bare politeness that they had no use for begemmed necklaces went round-eyed at the unset stones rolling about in Avienda's palm. Rihanna said they saw one as frippery, the other as wealth, but whatever their reasons, in return for two rubies of moderate size, one large moonstone, and a small firedrop, the people of Foral Market were more than willing to provide as many thick woolens as their visitors desired, some of them hardly worn. "Very generous of them," Nynaeve muttered sourly as people began rooting clothes out of their chests and attics. A steady stream marched into the inn with their arms full. Those stones could buy the whole village. Avienda shrugged slightly. She would have surrendered a handful of the gems if Rihanna had not intervened. Marilla shook her head. "We have what they want, but they have what we need. I'm afraid that means they set the price." Which was entirely too much like the situation with the sea folk. Nynaeve looked positively ill. When they were alone in a hallway of the inn, Elaine asked Avienda where she had gotten such a fortune in jewels, and one she seemed eager to be rid of. She expected her near sister to say they were her takings from the Stone of Tyr, or perhaps Cairion. "Randall Thor tricked me," Avienda muttered sullenly. "I tried to buy my toe from him. I know that is the least honorable way," she protested, "but I could see no other. And he stood me on my head. Why is it when you reason things out logically, a man always does something completely illogical and gains the upper hand?" "Their pretty heads are so fuzzy, a woman can't expect to follow how they skitter," Elaine told her. She did not inquire what toe Avienda had tried to buy, or how the attempt had ended with her near-sister possessing a sack full of rich gems. Talking about Rand was hard enough without where that might lead. Snow brought more than a need for warm clothing. At midday, with the snow flurries falling thicker by the minute, Renila strode down the stairs into the common room, proclaimed that her part of the bargain had been met, and demanded not only the bowl of the winds, but Marilla. The Grey Sisters stared in consternation, and so did a great many others. The benches were filled with kinswomen taking their turn at the midday meal, and serving men and women ran to serve this third lot of meals. Renila did not keep her voice down, and every head in the common room swiveled toward her. "You can begin your teaching now," Renila told the wide-eyed Aes Sedai. "Up the ladder with you to my quarters." Marilla started to protest, but face suddenly cold, the windfinder to the mistress of the ships planted fists on her hips. "When I give a command, Marilla Cian Devon," she said icily, "I expect every hand on deck to jump. Now jump." Marilla did not precisely jump, but she did gather herself and go, with Renila practically chivying her up the stairs from behind. Given her promise, she had no other choice. Rihanna's face was aghast. Alice and stout Sumiko, still wearing her red belt, watched thoughtfully. In the days that followed, whether laboring along a snow-covered road on their horses, walking the streets of a village, or trying to find room for everyone at a farm, Renila kept Marilla at her heels, except when she told her off to follow another windfinder. The glow of Sidar surrounded the Grey Sister and her escort almost constantly, and Marilla demonstrated weaves unceasingly. The pale Cairienin was markedly shorter than any of the dark sea-folk women,
But at first Marilla managed to stand taller by the sheer force of Aes Sedai dignity. Soon, though, she began to wear a permanently startled expression. Elaine learned that when they all had beds to sleep in, which they did not always, Marilla was sharing with Paul, her maid, and the two apprentice windfinders, Talan and Metara. What that said of Marilla's status, Elaine was not sure. Clearly the windfinders did not put her on a level with the apprentices. They just expected her to do as she was told, when she was told, with no delays or equivocations. Rihanna remained appalled at the turn of events, but Elise and Sumika were not the only ones among the kin to watch closely, not the only ones to nod thoughtfully. And suddenly another problem came to Elaine's notice. The kinswomen saw Ispan made more and more malleable in her captivity, but she was the prisoner of other Aes Sedai. The sea folk were not Aes Sedai, and Marilla not a prisoner, yet she was starting to jump when Renila issued a command, or for that matter when Dorilla or Kyra or Kyra's blood sister Tebrela did. Each of those was windfinder to a clan wave mistress, and none of the others made her hop with such alacrity, but that was enough. More and more of the kin slid from horrified gaping to thoughtful observation. Perhaps Aes Sedai were not a different flesh after all. If Aes Sedai were just women like themselves, why should they subject themselves once more to the rigors of the tower, to Aes Sedai authority and Aes Sedai discipline? Had they not survived very well on their own? Some for more years than any of the older sisters were quite ready to believe? Elaine could practically see the idea forming in their heads. When she mentioned it to Nynaeve, though, Nynaeve just muttered, "About time some of the sisters learned what it's like trying to teach a woman who thinks she knows more than her teacher. Those who have a chance at a shawl will still want it. And for the rest, I don't see why they shouldn't grow some backbone." Elaine refrained from mentioning Nynaeve's complaints about Sumika, who had certainly grown backbone. Sumika had criticized several of Nynaeve's healing weaves as clumsy, and Elaine had thought Nynaeve was going to have apoplexy on the spot. "In any case, there's no need to tell Egwene about this, if she's there. Any of it. She has enough on her plate." Without doubt, any of it referred to Marilla and the Windfinders. They were in their shifts, seated on their bed on the second floor of the new plough, with the twisted ring Dream Turangrial hanging about their necks, Elaine's on a simple leather cord, Nynaeve's alongside Lan's heavy signet ring on a narrow golden chain. Avienda and Birgitta, still fully dressed, sat on two of their clothing chests. Standing guard, they called it, until she and Nynaeve returned from the world of dreams. Both wore their cloaks until they could climb under the blankets. The new plough was definitely not new. Cracks spidered across the plastered walls, and unfortunate drafts crept in everywhere. The room itself was small, and the chests and stacked bundles left room for little beyond the bed and washstand. Elaine knew she had to present herself properly in Camelin, but sometimes she felt guilty, with her belongings on pack animals, when most others had to make do with what they could carry on their backs. Nynaeve certainly never showed any regrets over her chests. They had been 16 days on the road. The full moon outside the narrow window shone on a white blanket of snow that would make traveling tomorrow slow, even if the sky remained clear, and Elaine thought another week to Camelin was an optimistic estimate. "I have enough sense not to remind her," she told Nynaeve. "I don't want my nose snapped off again." That was a mild way of putting it. They had not been in Telairunriod since informing Egwene, the night after leaving the estate, that the bowl had been used. Reluctantly, they also had told her of the bargain they had been forced into with the sea folk, and found themselves facing the Ammerlin seat, with the striped stole on her shoulders. Elaine knew it was necessary and right. A queen's closest friend among her subjects knew she was the queen as well as a friend. Had to know. But she had not enjoyed her friend telling them in a heated voice that they had behaved like witless lubies who might have brought ruin down on all their heads, especially when she herself agreed. She had not liked hearing that the only reason Egwene did not set them both a penance that would curl their hair was that she could not afford to have them waste the time. Necessary and right, though. When she sat on the Lion Throne, she would still be Aes Sedai,
and subject to the laws and rules and customs of Aes Sedai. Not for Andor. She would not give her land to the White Tower, but for herself. So, unpleasant as it had been, she accepted her castigation calmly. Nynaeve had writhed and stammered with embarrassment, protested and all but pouted, then apologized so profusely that Elaine hardly believed it was the same woman she knew. Quite rightly, Egwene had remained the Ammerlin, cool in her displeasure, even while giving pardon for their mistakes. At best, tonight could not be pleasant or comfortable if she was there. But when they dreamed themselves into the Salidar of Telairun Riod, into the room in the little tower that had been called the Ammerlin's study, she was not there, and the only sign she had visited since their meeting was some barely visible words, roughly scratched on a beetle-riddled wall panel, as if by an idle hand that did not want to spend the effort to carve deeply. "Stay in Camelin." And a few feet away, "Keep silent and be careful." Those had been Egwene's final instructions to them. Go to Camelin and stay there until she could puzzle out how to keep the hall from salting all of them down and nailing them into a barrel, a reminder they had no way to erase. Embracing Sidar, Elaine channeled to leave her own message, the number 15 seemingly scratched on the heavy table that had been Egwene's writing desk. Inverting the weave and tying it off meant that only someone who ran her fingers across the numerals would realize they were not really there. Perhaps it would not take 15 days to reach Camelin, but more than a week, she was certain. Nynaeve strode to the window and peered out both ways, careful not to put her head out through the open casement. It was night out there, as in the waking world, a full moon gleaming on bright snow, though the air did not feel cold. No one else should be there except them, and if anyone was, it was someone to avoid. "I hope she isn't having trouble with her plans," she muttered.
"She told us not to mention those even to each other, Nynaeve. A secret spoken finds wings." That had been another of Linny's many favorites. Nynaeve grimaced over her shoulder, then returned to peering down the narrow alley.
"It's different for you. I tended her as a child, changed her swaddling, smacked her bottom a time or two, and now I have to leap when she snaps her fingers. It's hard."
Elaine could not help herself.
She snapped her fingers.
Nynaeve spun so fast that she blurred, her face pop-eyed with horror. Her dress blurred, too, from blue riding silks to an accepted's banded white to what she referred to as good, stout, two-rivers wool, dark and thick. When she realized Egwene was not there, had not been listening, she almost fainted with relief. When they stepped back to their bodies and woke long enough to tell the others they could come to bed, Avienda certainly thought it a good joke, and Birgitta laughed as well. Nynaeve had her revenge, though. The next morning she woke Elaine with an icicle. Elaine's shrieks woke everybody else in the whole village. 3 days later the first explosion came.